everyone. Welcome to News and Brew Sports Biz, our podcast series that advocates for the financial voices in college athletics and features new developments impacting the business. I'm Katie Davis.
And I'm Ken Kurdzel. Joining us today is Kelly Fagan, a partner in the sports law practice at the Indiana law firm Church, Church, Hiddle, and Antrim. Welcome, Kelly.
Well, hello, and thank you guys for having me. It's good to be here with you, Katie and Ken.
Thanks for being on with us, Kelly. Let's start off by having you share a little bit about your background and career path and your role at CCHA.
Sure. So I've grown up in Indianapolis, in Indiana, which is a great place to be for a sports fan, particularly an amateur sports fan. So I really never left. I was a student athlete at University of Indianapolis, and really had an interest in going to law school for when I was in college, and wanted to kind of combine the sports into that in some way, and was lucky enough to get an opportunity at the NCAA and their enforcement department when I was in college. And then they let me stick around for a little bit between college and law school. And I found that work really fun and interesting. It had a lot of the legal elements. A lot of the people in the enforcement department then and now had been to law school and were trained lawyers. And I thought it was really interesting, fun work. It wasn't really real law because it was NCAA law. It wasn't going to court, which is not, I didn't want to litigate or anything like that. And so then when I graduated from law school, I reconnected with some people, and CCHA gave me an opportunity to start here and to start a sports law practice that they didn't have at the time. So I joined up with Julie Rolash, who's the current commissioner of the Horizon League, and she's of counsel with our firm. And we just started building the practice from there. And primarily the work that we do, and, you know, it started in a smaller scope, and it's really grown significantly, is representing institutions, coaches, student athletes through kind of anything related to the NCAA, whether that's an investigation, a waiver, just proactively understanding and having a better handle on NCAA rules. And then as our work expanded, we became very involved with Title IX work, which is the real law of what I do. And because there was so much intersection, obviously, with athletics, there's always been, but with, as I'm sure we'll talk about today, just as college sports change, so many other laws are being impacted. So expanded that to Title IX work. And so we do a lot in those two areas, and work with schools across the country, athletes and coaches across the country, and really have kind of a nice diverse set of clients that we get to serve on a day-to-day basis.
That sounds like a really fun, fun job, quite frankly. And that's awesome that you were able to combine your love of sports with the law and all of that.
And so, similar to what we do. And it's funny because we say NCAA accounting isn't real accounting. So it's the same with law too. So that's pretty good.
That's great. So Kelly, talk to us a little bit about what you're mostly seeing come through your collegiate athletics practice lately.
So I mean, NIL is sort of the word of every day, it feels like. What's going to happen? What are the impacts going to be, you know, for each institution? What's it going to have in the industry? What impact will it have on potential federal legislation? So it feels like since pre-2021, June, July 2021, when the interim policy went into place after the Alston decision was announced, it feels like it's that NIL is sort of an everyday thing, but it's as you guys know, it's looked so different from in the last 3 years. Most recently, it's a lot of trying to understand and predict and get clients ready for what some of the new institutional, potentially new institutional involvement legislation could look like coming out of the convention in January. There was the proposed expedited legislation to try to open that up a little bit. But we haven't heard updates, at least to the public at large, as sort of what what the next step is on that, if there will be a vote, if it will go into effect, if it'll look different than what was proposed. So it seems like it's sort of NIL consistently. And then because of the potential changes or making that legislation more permissible, Title IX just has a could be significantly impacted by that, and it, because the more the institution is involved, the more potentially Title IX will come into play. And it's interesting because Title IX in athletics, it's got very fundamental aspects to it. It's been in existence for decades, but those fundamentals are being challenged and kind of stretched into new areas that maybe the original law didn't contemplate, surely, at the time. But we really haven't gotten any guidance from the government, from OCR, as to how to apply that to some of these new potential models. Maybe they're going to see how it all shakes out and then say something, but it's a big question mark right now in terms of how schools in the future will comply with Title IX.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we've got a lot of Title IX questions coming up for you. But I guess taking a step back, like, where are you and your sports law colleagues focused right now on this evolution of institutional involvement with NIL?
I think it's sort of trying to model out what this could look like. And so if it ends up being, you know, institutions can be more involved, but short of any sort of direct payment to student athletes, you know, what is the impact of that? How can our clients that are of various sizes and shapes and resources, how can they use that, you know, potentially more institutional involvement to benefit them, but also mitigate risks that come with that? Because just because of the size, particularly of Division I, and there's so many different schools, and it's just it's kind of crazy that it's gotten to this point where, you know, largely the same rules apply across the board to those 300 plus institutions. So there's a bit of prognostication, but you can only do so much in that until you actually see it, how it comes out. But it's just it's trying to get them to a place where, you know, they can be ready to react, you know, trying to understand the relationship with the collectives at schools. What will their role be, if any, going forward? You know, are they merged? Are they related entities? Are they kept separate? So just trying to think about some of those possibilities so that if and when something changes, you've at least put some thought into it up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that they're, I mean, I know that's what you're kind of focused on your side. As you're having conversations with schools, are they open to thinking about those kinds of things, or are they like more, for lack of a better term, head in the sand a little bit of like, we're not going to react to anything until we know what it is? Like, what are you seeing more?
It varies. It really kind of client to client, because I think some are more willing to sort of go through those mental exercises, and some are just trying to put out the next fire, you know, that's in front of them. So it does vary, but I think it just causes a lot of stress and the uncertainty of it all. And you know, it seems like every day that goes by, some new legislation is proposed. And I saw the Virginia legislation that was kind of publicized yesterday that allows the institutions to make direct payments. So it's I think there is a bit of that, what you said, Katie, of, well, if it's easier if we just kind of wait and see what happens, because it might change, mm-hmm. versus get ready for this possibility or get ready for that possibility.
Well, and it seems it echoes back to me to like those early months of NIL, where there was a patchwork with every state doing something different. And okay, so now you'll have Virginia lead the way with, you know, legislation doing this. And then we know, of course, that'll trickle to other states too. Yeah. So what kind of conversations is this leading to with athletic departments and maybe even general counsel's office for the universities? Are you having conversations in that area?
Yeah, so it's trying to help them sort of I thread that needle between trying to you don't want to come up with, solutions when you don't know what the model is or what the problem is. So, but having a good idea of what you have now. We've been using this what we call our NIL assessment, and it sort of looks at all the different campus groups, the different functions, different policies and procedures, and just does sort of a status quo. How are they, what are they doing? How are they doing? How are they interacting? How are they staffed? What are budgets look like? Just to make sure that they know what they have, versus having, individuals separately working on things and then not having the communication or the collaboration there. So that's been a useful tool to sort of ensure that general counsel, who a lot of, some of the highly resourced schools have a specific athletics attorney or athletics liaison, but many don't, most don't. So that is a tool that gives them the ability to sort of see everything that's out there if they don't have the time to go have all those conversations and gather that information themselves. And then when they know the baseline, then they are, more prepared to be able to react when that comes. Another area is, institutions don't stop entering into contractual relationships just because legislation may change. So it's trying to build some flexibility into those to get people to think forward about those, so that if there is a significant change and they don't want to be hamstrung by a contractual obligation, that would prevent them from doing something. So, sort of like what we've seen with some of the state laws that they then had to repeal or amend because it was too prohibitive, is just trying to anticipate that, explain that to vendors who may not be familiar with it. Most are when it's dealing with athletics, but just trying to be forward thinking in that and not put schools in a position where they're not able to react or do something because of a contractual obligation.
Yeah, that the contractual part's a good point. And I think we saw a lot of that even just going into COVID and how contracts changed and kept athletic departments hamstrung a little bit, and even how some of the vendors felt a little hamstrung. And so I can imagine, with NIL coming in-house, a lot of these vendors are probably also changing their strategies. So it would be good to coordinate those changes together and be more
Yeah.
collaborative there. So how does Title IX come into play as it relates to institutional involvement?
So I'll try not to get too legalistic here, but so Title IX, most people understand that it does not pro it prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex for educational institutions that receive federal funding. That can extend that. In athletics, you see that in terms of participation opportunities, the proportionality and financial assistance and treatment areas are the laundry list, which is all sorts of things like recruiting, travel, meals, medical services, tutoring. So it's a whole list of things. And so that's sort of the athletics part of it. But Title IX also prohibits schools from aiding or perpetuating discrimination by providing significant assistance to outside organizations that may discriminate on the basis of sex. So maybe those organizations aren't subject to Title IX or other federal law. So if there, so that significant assistance becomes important to for schools to avoid if there is some third party that may not be subject to Title IX. In OCR, it's a sort of a case-by-case basis, and it looks at factors like if the organization is given special status or privileges that are not offered to other community organizations, if there's some official recognition of the organization by the university, if there's faculty involvement or faculty sponsors, if they're permitting use of IP or campus facilities that is at less than fair market value. So there's a kind of a whole list of things that they look at to determine if there's significant assistance. We haven't seen that explicitly applied in the world of collectives and college sports. But just as I'm kind of listing those things, I'm sure that that sort of puts, you know, people's antenna up. That sounds a lot like what we see some schools doing with collectives. The case that's out in Oregon where the plaintiffs are alleging, you know, that Oregon is essentially responsible for its collective is the first case I'm aware of, at least, that is sort of challenging that or trying to see if how current collectives are set up, if universities could be responsible for them. Because without that, if they're totally separate or there's sufficient separation, then collectives as private entities aren't subject to Title IX. So if institutional involvement expands, and institutions are permitted to be more involved in NIL, then you can see how that can could push you closer to triggering that significant assistance. Or if institutions are ever permitted to provide direct NIL payments to student athletes, then I think there's a pretty strong argument that that those would be subject to Title IX because of the financial assistance part of the Title IX gender equity analysis, that it needs to be proportional. So those are, so it's almost like we may be there. We'll see if this court case or if we ever get any sort of regulatory guidance, you know, based on the current structure, but we're certainly moving closer to Title IX having some direct implications for NIL, the more an institution can be involved. So hopefully that was clear and wasn't too legalistic.
No, definitely. And just to stay on that topic for a second, more prognostic, you know, looking forward a little bit, if that does happen, how would Title IX be impacted as to whether or not, you know, it's athletes being paid under NIL contracts versus a revenue sharing or as employees? Are there impacts to those different possible models that, and how Title IX would interplay with it?
So for NIL contracts, it'll depend on sort of who's paying, or who's facilitating, who's providing the benefit. So if it's just a strict third party, a student athlete gets a deal with a local car dealership, shouldn't be any, and it was sort of on their own, shouldn't be any implication. If institutions can be more involved in helping them procure those deals or facilitate them, then it's very likely that that's a benefit that they're that the school is providing, and that they should do that in an equitable manner based on the treatment areas, the laundry list of things that they're supposed to provide equitably. So if they're only doing that for the men's basketball team, or there's a, you know, a director of NIL that's out there facilitating deals and promoting those for only male student athletes, then that could potentially be a problem. So it kind of comes down to the nuances of it. If the school is actually paying for NIL deals, if we get to that stage, then it may be on that financial assistance part of Title IX that there would need to be, that it would need to meet that criteria. If there is revenue share, so I'll kind of break them down. If there's a revenue share model, I mean, some of what we've seen is sort of that there's some amount that's attached to a student athlete's participation, and it goes in an escrow account, and then they get it upon graduation. And so the eligibility for that would likely need to be sort of the same requirements. So you shouldn't have different requirements for female student athletes than you would for male student athletes. If the revenue share is being shared by some other entity, then it kind of goes back to the same question on the NIL, like what support are institutions providing? Is the other entity that significant assistance that sort of folds them into Title IX? So it's very complicated to try to anticipate what that would look like. On the employee side, if they're employees of universities, and they're being paid a wage, then that, again, that financial assistance requirement that it be proportional is, would likely come into effect. And It's not like Title IX would just fully go away if they were employees, because they're still providing them benefits. It would look different, but it's similar to like Alston payments that are within the scholarship, are included in the financial assistance and the scholarship, the cost of attendance that they get. So it's just kind of a similar analysis.
I think, there's the whole conversation of, as more money is going to these revenue generating athletes, it's going to impact Olympic sports. And of course, then that's going to have a huge Title IX implication. And some of the conversations that I've been having recently have been around, who's responsible for funding, to keep those sports, right? And to remain in compliance with Title IX. And ultimately, it's the university's responsibility, not necessarily athletics. Of course, the conversation though then turns to, well, what kind of a, chaotic storm is going to spin out if they start saying, well, you need to give athletics more money to be able to fund these sports, because that's not going to be necessarily received well by the student body or faculty of the university. But at the end of the day, it's not just the athletic department that has to comply with Title IX. It's the entire institution.
Yes. Yeah. The areas we've been talking about are sort of unique and specific to athletics, but Title IX's a university-wide obligation. And it feels like, Katie, that goes sort of to almost like a philosophical question that universities would have to ask themselves, is the value that they see, not just the financial value, but I mean, there's a lot that as a golf student athlete, I never wanted to be an employee. I never imagined getting NIL deals. I would have welcomed that, but I had a much different mindset than, the starting quarterback of a Division I, Big Ten school. So it feels like it would really come to institutions deciding what is important to them, because even if you're not getting the value from a revenue standpoint from some of those sports, there's still visibility, there's still branding, there's still a lot of things that I think universities hold, as intangibly valuable for athletics, even if they're not revenue generating.
Yeah, and along the same lines of what you were talking about with assessments, is while you don't necessarily need to go in and make wholesale changes to what you're currently doing until you know how to change them, there are a lot of financial projections that could be happening right now based on these different scenarios that you just talked through. And what does that mean? Where is the money coming from? Where's the money going? And sure, you can say, oh, it's going to hurt Olympic sports, but I think until you've actually run the numbers under the different scenarios to really be able to quantify what that looks like and the impact, it's hard to really then make a plan for it and develop a communication plan around it. So, we think that's something that's really important to start looking at now, just to kind of try to grasp, a minimum impact, a maximum impact, and kind of what falls in the middle.
Yeah,
But
it seems like there's at least some of the major schools that have a significant amount of money are almost, trying to set aside funds for that possibility. Or start to set aside funds and grow that for a different model. Not every school, as you said, would be able to do that, but that's where that, like what you're talking about, and an assessment comes in of what are options out there? What is there anything we can do now? And if not, just sort of knowing what those options are.
Well, and making good decisions on operating the department elsewhere, like we saw recently, the athletic director at Ole Miss specifically said, we're sure we can make upgrades to our football stadium, but that doesn't make sense in this current environment, because I
Yeah.
think the worst thing is to do a massive facility upgrade and have all that debt service and those obligations, and then all of a sudden have to have money to pay athletes.
Yeah, the facility arms race that seems like that's been such a huge recruiting tool may become less important as some of these other things come into play.
Yeah, unfortunately, those that upgraded their facilities in the last few years, still have a lot of bond payments to make.
They're on the hook. Yeah,
They're
exactly.
on the hook. It's not easy to just
Yeah.
say, oh, okay, we're going to
Yeah.
move this money over
It's not
here
easy
now.
to pivot. Yep.
Yeah. Well, what do you recommend that universities do now to prepare for eventual whatever it is? But I mean, I would easily bet my money that there will be some form of institutional involvement coming soon.
Yeah.
So what do you think they should do now to prepare for that?
I think two things. One is engage with, if you have a state law, engage with, your legislators to prepare them for potential changes so that if you need to move quickly to change something or do something, that they're ready to do that. And my other thing is just do something. Don't put your head in the sand. At least have discussions, make yourself aware of what's going on campus. On some, it doesn't have to be a granular level, but have a good handle on, how your admissions are working with your athletics. If you have an NIL person in athletics, ensuring that there's a good, a good working group or task force, and that everybody is up to speed on the current status, so that you're not having to climb from behind and do that. So those are the two things. I think that's going to look different for every school, but that the schools could be doing.
Those are great suggestions and consistent with where Katie and I are with our clients, just kind of trying to, again, avoid that head in the sand mentality and, maybe begin to model some of this, look at their infrastructure for how well they're set up for more institutional involvement and things coming in-house, and just at least having the dialogue, because it's definitely coming, and it's coming much faster than anyone in the industry expected, that without a doubt.
Yeah, that November date that's in the Virginia legislation. I was like, okay, well, there's a date now, but someone else is going to say,
Accelerate it even
hold my
closer.
beer, watch
Yeah.
us. We're
Yeah.
going to have a faster implementation
All
date.
dispersed. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a good pivot, the hold my beer, because the second half of our podcast name is Brews, and that started with Katie and I and our travels, always enjoying a local craft brewery, but we've really expanded that to be any beverage of choice. So, Kelly, what have you been enjoying lately and would like to share about?
So I'm gonna give you two. One is I'm not a beer drinker, but one is a wine that I got to go to New Zealand several years ago to some wineries and fell in love with a Sauvignon Blanc called Cloudy Bay. And occasionally I can find it in stores in Indy, so I will buy several whenever I do see it. And then the other is a local. It's from Columbus, started in Columbus, Indiana. And it's called Mom Water, and it's essentially a seltzer without the carbonation, but it's the different flavors are names like Karen or Linda or Julie, and I love those, and they're a good conversation starter, and they're fun to see what the new names are going to be. They just started a Dad Water that I haven't had any yet, but those are my two.
That's great,
Yeah,
Katie.
that actually sounds really good. So I actually have two as well, and my first one is a wine. So last month I mentioned I was going to Spain, and I had not super familiar with Spanish wines. And so while I'm normally a red wine drinker and loved the red wines they had, I also really liked their Albariño, which is a white wine that's a little bit sweeter and really good. And then my second brew is from a local brewery in Gainesville, Florida, called Blackadder. And every year they put out around Valentine's Day a beer they call Date Night, and it wins a lot of awards. It's a Belgian quad, and so it's a really heavy beer, but it's made with dates and other things, so it gives it a really good, not hoppy flavor. So it's very opposite from the IPAs that sometimes I also drink, but it's also really good. How about you, Ken?
So having you on the podcast made me think of Indianapolis and how much when we're up there, I enjoy a brewery there called Gugman House.
Oh,
And
yeah.
definitely would encourage anybody coming through the Indianapolis area, which is a great city, by the way, to stop there, because I thought their beers were just dynamite.
Yeah, we had a conference. We had the Regional Rules was in Indy last year, and we put together for our clients that would be coming in sort of things to do in Indy, and that was one of them where we recommended people go.
It's a great choice.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. This was fun. I appreciate it.
You've definitely given our listeners a lot to be thinking about. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Cheers.
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 To learn more about the James Moore & Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at JMCO Higher Ed and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.